Welcome back to Clinicians Brief, the podcast, the conversations behind the content. I'm your host, registered veterinary technician, Becky Mosser. In today's conversation, we're joined by Dr. Timothy Phan. Dr. Timothy Phan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited for this conversation today, talking about your article in the March 2020 Journal of Clinicians Brief, talking about canine hemangiosarcoma. But before we get into all of that, I just want to hear a little bit more about you. You're up at the University of Illinois, right?
That's right.
So tell me a little bit about your background. How did you end up at the University of Illinois? How did you end up specializing in internal med? What did your journey look like?
Yeah, I think that my journey was very convoluted, right? Kind of evolved as everything went along. Graduated from Virginia, Maryland College of Vet Med in 95. I did an internship here at Illinois from 95 to 96. Went to Cornell and did an internal medicine residency and came back to Illinois in 1998 and did an oncology fellowship and have been at Illinois since 1998. So it's been quite a while, 22 years, and it's been a lot of fun. I think during that 22 years, kind of transitioned from much more clinical orientation to more researchy type of interest. And so currently most of my time is divided, but majority of time is spent towards research that is hopefully helping dogs and cats with cancer and providing some new information that may help guide treatments for people with cancer as well. So that's kind of my story there.
I mean, that's pretty, honestly, that's heroic work. At what point did you decide, you know, cancer was where you really wanted to focus?
I think that happened during my internal medicine residency. So from 96 to 1998, I did a internal medicine residency. And I thought the coolest cases that I saw as a resident were dogs or cats that had underlying cancer, right? So as an internist, you're there as a detective and you need to figure out what's going on with the patient. And many of these patients had cancer, and those were the most memorable cases. I would say out of the top five cases that I saw as an internal medicine resident, probably four of the five were cancer-related diseases, and that really piqued my interest in cancer.
Now, I just want to ask you this, Dr. Phan, like, what does a day in the life of you look like? Like, what do you go to work and do when you're researching cancer? Are you looking at blood? Are you looking at tissue? Are you looking at live animals? Like, what does a day in the life of you look like when you're trying to break this down?
I think I try to be comprehensive and balanced. And so I think a day in the life is, how do we connect the dots? Meaning we have to do stuff in the laboratory that deals with cells that grow in plastic, right? So these are cell cultures. We do a lot of work with cell cultures, but we recognize that growing tumor cells on plastic is convenient and allows us to do rapid tests, but it is really poorly recapitulating or poorly reflecting how the disease actually behaves in a living animal. So we do a lot of stuff in the lab that is predominantly with cell lines growing on plastic. We do some work in mouse models of cancer as well. And more importantly for me, because I'm a veterinarian, we do a lot of work in dogs and cats that have cancers to better understand their behavior in a natural setting when the disease occurs spontaneously in an animal that has a normal immune functioning system, right? So these are the ways that we study cancer. And so the day in the life of Tim Phan is trying to coordinate the efforts of multiple people. So there are many people involved in this discovery process. I try to kind of coordinate that everyone's kind of rowing in a unified direction. And this helps expedite the discovery process, helps generate data more quickly. And hopefully this data can lead to better understanding of cancer as well as the identification of new therapies that could help dogs and cats with cancer.
Gosh, I mean, I'm such a lab geek, so I'm just like totally geeking out on what you do all day and how much work you guys put in, day out. And I think like one thing that was really meaningful to me was, you know, your objectives, you don't have an expectation that your objectives will be solved in your lifetime. And so I just like want to take a minute to recognize like how honorable that is. You go to work all day, every day to do something that you know will not likely get accomplished in your time, but to to contribute to what is obviously going to be a lifetime of work. And I just think what you guys do is really amazing and honorable and very exciting. And so I thank you for that hard work, because it's really neat and such an interesting topic to dive into. Were you really one of those people who always knew you wanted to be a veterinarian, or did that come along later in life?
I think that I knew I really liked dogs in particular when I was young. And so I really wanted to be a veterinarian probably during my early teenage years. And I kind of pursued that. I started working at a local vet clinic when I was 16, and that just kind of solidified my interest. And I think that certainly that was kind of my passion. I've always been very interested in that. So I've been fortunate that I could follow up on that passion and be in the career that I've had so far.
I love it because, you know, the majority of veterinarians that I talk to have known most of their life that this is where they wanted to end up. And I think that's such a beautiful thing, really, that our industry is made up of lifelong dreamers, right? People who have really wanted to be there their whole lives. And then they all find these kind of places where the chips fall within veterinary medicine that is, you know, for them. And when it comes to cancer, I think we all hear oncology, oncologists, cancer, chemo, and a special place in our heart is triggered, right? Like, we know these are some of the hardest cases, and you know, you said the coolest, but I think that from like a medical standpoint, they are fascinating, and it is fascinating. And I guess what I want to ask you, and it's without boundaries, when you talk about cancer research, are you here to eradicate cancer? Are you trying to get rid of it, or are you really studying treatments for cancer? Like, what is going on behind the doors? What's the ultimate goal? Are you trying to put yourself out of a job?
Well, I think the ultimate goal obviously is to find better treatments, and those better treatments, there can be different expectations that are achievable. The greatest expectation would be to cure cancer.
Yeah.
But I think that a global cure across all tumors, that is not going to be seen in my lifetime. So I think that we need to make impact where we can make impact. And so a lot of those realizations of improving cancer management is driven by not only discovery and science, but also technological advancements. And so I do think that, you know, in the course of my career and lifetime, there will be clear improvements in how we manage cancers, not only in dogs and cats, but also people. And so the holy grail, obviously, is to cure cancer globally across all tumor types. But I think for my goals is really to focus on a few tumor types that are very problematic in dogs and cats and try to improve their management through science and discovery, as well as to accelerate new technologies to help treat those animals.
Well, I mean, I'm grateful that you are. And you know, I think we're all grateful that you are, because what we're talking about today is actually, I feel like, something we all dip our toe in at some point or another when we're dealing with canine hemangiosarcoma. It's something we see so much. And I just want to create kind of the expectation now. This article is entitled Canine Hemangiosarcoma. So for our understanding for this conversation, I just kind of want to, it's funny, right? We're talking about canine, but tell me to start about cats. Like, does any of this apply to cats? Does some of it apply to cats? Are we totally talking dogs here? And we'll have you back to talk about cats. I just kind of want to set that expectation up in the beginning.
Sure. I think that we always say that cats are not necessarily small dogs, but there are some similarities, but there are also differences in this disease, specifically between dogs and cats. For cats, so I think that if we look at three species that can develop this type of tumor, dogs by far are much more common to develop this type of tumor. Cats and human beings are less frequently developing these type of tumors. In cats, there are similar parts of the body that are affected by hemangiosarcoma. More often in cats, we have kind of skin involvement or subcutaneous involvement, but we do also have about half of cats that will show with what we call visceral tumor involvement. So tumors that are hemangiosarcoma that arise from the liver or affect the small intestine or large intestine or mesentery or spleen. So we do see very similar diseases in cats compared to dogs. The frequency is much less, but I do believe that at least the visceral forms of this disease in cats is highly malignant, just as we see in dogs. So I think uniformly this disease is a highly problematic, often lethal disease, regardless if you're a dog or a cat.
Okay. And I appreciate you differentiating that. And it's true. I don't think we see it as frequently in cats in my experience, but I know like you said, cats are not small dogs. So sometimes there's similarities, sometimes they're not. And again, what you kind of talk about ties into one of my first questions, which is just the highly malignant nature of hemangiosarcoma. And I think that's reflected in, you know, most of the experiences we have across the board in practice. I think this is a pretty dreaded diagnosis. You know, I know that unfortunately you see these dogs come in and you almost see them from outside. You're just like, oh man, this is that. And I know where we're going with this. So can you talk a little bit to that pathophysiology? Because it's quite an interesting pathology involved in the involvement of the visceral organs, as well as the metastasizing nature of these tumors. Can you just kind of explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think that the important aspects of canine hemangiosarcoma is to recognize that they're different anatomic forms, and they're also different what we call molecular subtypes, so the type of hemangiosarcoma. In dogs, we do see the majority of these tumors arising from the spleen. So about 50% of hemangiosarcomas in dogs are arising from the spleen. There's about 25% of dogs that have more skin or subcutaneous or muscle involvement. And then we obviously have involvement of the heart is an area, the auricle, and we also have a lesser amount involving the liver. And so I think that pathology of this disease is really driven by a tumor that it's made up of endothelial cells. These are cells that make up the lining of your blood vessels. And so these tumors, by the nature of the cell that they arise from, are very bloody. And what happens in these type of tumors is that as the tumors grow, there is less and less oxygen that is there to perfuse that tumor. In addition, the blood vessels that are formed in hemangiosarcoma are very chaotic. They're very poorly formed, and that leads to what we call stasis of blood. So blood does not flow very cleanly or freely through these tumors. And this leads to areas of the tumor to be deprived of oxygen. And this leads to areas that actually become unhealthy and break open and bleed. So this is the problem with this tumor, is that as that tumor grows, it tends to become unhealthy because it's not getting enough oxygen. And that leads to areas of that tumor to break open and bleed. This is how we see most of these dogs clinically manifest, with acute bleeding episodes, usually within the abdominal cavity. And so I think that's the dreaded component of this disease, is that most dogs are relatively asymptomatic until something catastrophic happens. And this is a real problem in trying to manage this disease proactively, right? So we don't know there's a problem until the Titanic has hit that iceberg, right? And so this is something that we need to work on from a discovery standpoint, to identify dogs that are at risk, or to identify early markers to figure out which dogs should be more closely monitored before this catastrophic event happens.
I mean, so that actually is exactly my next question to you, because it ties in perfectly. Because in my experience, you know, most of the dogs that I see are otherwise clinically normal. And, you know, all of a sudden there's this acute situation. We have this ruptured tumor, the dog's down, you know, it's just... Or sudden death. It, like you said, it is very impactful that way. So I wonder, like, what do we have right now to detect these tumors sooner in pets? What's up and coming with this? How can we be doing our best practices around this?
So I think that in order to improve the management of cancer, regardless of species, you know, dog, cat, human, there are two fundamental pillars that we need to think about. One is early detection. The other is improved therapies, right? And if you have both of those, early detection with better therapies, I think we're on the right road towards improving the management of cancer. And so if we think about how can we detect hemangiosarcoma earlier in susceptible dogs, probably what is most practical right now is routine screening with imaging modalities, right? And so going back to the classic presentation of a dog with hemangiosarcoma, most of these tumors involve an internal organ, such as the spleen.
Yeah.
And that spleen is not something that we can see outwardly with our eyes, or it's not something that we can readily appreciate just with our hands, like on physical exam. And so one way to improve early diagnosis before a catastrophic hemorrhage would be to practice more proactive routine screening with abdominal ultrasound would be the most practical way. However, that still is a limited practice, right? So not everyone is going to have an ultrasound in their clinic. Not every pet owner is going to be interested in doing an ultrasound. And so I think that coupled with imaging like ultrasound, there is a lot of scientific research in early detection of disease that occurs before you actually have a large visible tumor that could be seen by ultrasound. And so these are technologies that are currently being evaluated in which you can collect the blood from a dog. So this would be what we term a liquid biopsy, right? So taking a small amount of blood from a dog and then looking for specific rare cells in the circulation of the dog to categorize that dog as, is this a dog that will be a high risk for developing hemangiosarcoma in the next several months or low risk? And so this is a fundamentally important and likely transformative research that's ongoing, spearheaded by the University of Minnesota from the Modiano lab. And so I think that there's great interest and great potential value as this diagnostic platform gets evaluated in its accuracy.
That's incredibly exciting, right? To be able to look at this from a blood test factor. And honestly, it comes back to the amazing work that you're doing, I know, with so many others, because, you know, we are able to see some predisposition, right? And so it makes me kind of wonder, just with my interest in genetic markers, do you think, or are there signs of any kind of genetic markers for this that we could be testing for as well?
I think from genetic markers, there isn't anything that is uniform, meaning that so in order for a genetic marker to be useful, there's two things that you need. One is that the process of cancer has to be detectable from cells that are shed into the bloodstream. So that's one component that I think that we're getting closer to. We're being able to identify suspect cells. But the other component that's necessary for a genetic marker to be useful is that there has to be a uniform gene mutation that you could reliably detect in a vast majority of these tumor cells. And I think that's where we don't have a good handle yet, right? So certain tumors are driven by known what we call chromosomal rearrangements. So these are genetic changes that are reproducibly found in every tumor cell. And we don't have that genetic marker per se in canine hemangiosarcoma. There are certainly studies that are looking at actionable gene mutations as therapeutic targets, but again, not every tumor is going to have these gene mutations. And because in reality, perhaps only a small fraction will have conserved gene markers, currently we're not at a stage that we can have a readily available, reliable genetic marker for hemangiosarcoma, at least to my knowledge.
Sure. No, absolutely. And then I guess it makes me wonder, are there any environmental factors or any known environmental factors that you guys are discovering?
I think that for certain forms of hemangiosarcoma, we feel there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest environmental factors. And a specific would be cutaneous hemangiosarcoma, right? So hemangiosarcoma that involves the skin of dogs, we have strong epidemiologic suggestion that this is driven by ultraviolet radiation, right? So these are superficial tumors that tend to be found in lightly pigmented, thinly haired dogs. And so there's suggestion that ultraviolet radiation that has the potential to lead to accumulation of DNA damages over time may be a driving factor or predisposing factor for the development of hemangiosarcoma in dogs. When it comes to the more common visceral forms of hemangiosarcoma, like the spleen or the heart, I don't think that we have a good handle on what may be an environmental factor. In people, there's quite a bit of evidence that suggests exposures to different carcinogenic chemicals like vinyl chloride, these type of occupational risks or hazards increases the likelihood of angiosarcoma, which is the comparative tumor in human beings. But I don't think that we have clear evidence of that in dogs at this point.
If you're already reading Clinician's Brief, why not get credit for it? Get affordable, race-approved CE from Clinician's Brief content you trust without leaving your desk. You can track your earned hours, receipts, and certificates and see the latest available courses at cliniciansbrief.com/CE. Get started today. One thing I wanted to ask you about too is you present some pretty expansive discussion around the treatment options for hemangiosarcoma and the overall goals of treatment. You know, we've already talked about at this point, mainly palliative as discoveries are being made, but there are a lot of different options you talk about from surgery to complementary therapy. So just wanted to take some time to walk through these different options, you know, maybe say starting with surgical, what kind of options are we looking at for, I think that's where most of us are comfortable.
Yeah, I think that surgery is always going to be a cornerstone of therapy. If you can remove a tumor and decrease the overall tumor burden in a PET, I think that there's a great benefit to that for many patients. I think hemangiosarcoma is complicated though, because not only do we have problems with the local tumor, like splenectomy is very useful in trying to prevent future re-bleeds, but we do know that this tumor has a very, very aggressive nature in its ability to spread or metastasize. And so surgery in that fashion of addressing metastasis is insufficient. And that's why we always try to couple surgery with other systemic forms of therapy. And that's kind of where the chemotherapy talk usually comes in. And I do think that there's sufficient evidence in the literature to indicate that systemic chemotherapy does improve survival time of dogs with hemangiosarcoma. Although I think that those survival time improvements are relatively marginal to modest, and that should serve as further impetus for researchers and clinicians to put their heads together to identify better treatment options besides the conventional chemotherapeutic route. I do think that technologically, with advancements in radiation facilities, so stereotactic radiosurgery is a really advanced radiation technology. There's going to be greater involvement of this type of local treatment option for hemangiosarcomas that may be found in difficult places, like if it's involving the heart. Surgery may be difficult, but stereotactic radiosurgery with the delivery of radiation therapy might be very effective in palliating that. And then in addition to all of these more conventional therapies with surgery and chemotherapy, there are complementary therapies that are of great interest to pet owners. Many of those complementary therapies are the use of kind of herbal remedies. And so I think many people have heard about Union Baiyao, which is kind of a proprietary ingredient. I think there are like 8 to 10 ingredients in it that's proprietary, but it is believed to potentiate or increase the ability of blood to clot. And so certainly there's, I think, evidence that topical application to wounds would facilitate platelet adhesion and aggregation. I think there's much less evidence for if you ingest this compound, how does that actually change your blood clotting abilities? But nonetheless, I think Union Baiyao is being looked at quite heavily for dogs with hemangiosarcoma. I think it'll be important to do prospective studies to really bear out if there's a benefit to that herbal remedy. Along the same lines, there is something called Y-immunity, which is really a mushroom extract. I think it's Yongzhang mushroom, or also known as the turkey tail fungus. This is a mushroom extract that uses a polysaccharide peptide. This is a protein carbohydrate molecule that is believed to induce the immune system to become pro-inflammatory, so to activate the immune system and hopefully could help fight different forms of cancer. And certainly there have been some early studies that were published in 2012 that looked at the potential benefit in a group of dogs with hemangiosarcoma. So I think those are all complementary studies that should be further investigated for their value in managing hemangiosarcoma. But I think there's a lot of additional other therapies that have quite a bit of science behind them right now. And so ongoing studies would look at the use of propranolol with doxorubicin. That's an active clinical trial being evaluated for dogs with hemangiosarcoma. And certainly there are some innovative therapies that look at a targeted poison that relies upon two receptors that are expressed by hemangiosarcoma. And so these are technologies that are backed with a lot of scientific research that hopefully will be transformative for dogs with hemangiosarcoma.
Is there currently case studies that are being run that you know of? Like if we have a client who we are discovering hemangiosarcomas, you know, where do we send them to offer more information and to help in, you know, creating more solutions?
So I think that the two agents that are being actively investigated that I know of, at least, so propranolol with doxorubicin is being studied at three sites. It's spearheaded through the University of Minnesota, but University of Pennsylvania is involved in that, and Purdue University is involved in that. So there are at least three sites that are accruing dogs for that type of study. And then the University of Minnesota is also spearheading their, what we call their bispecific toxin therapy called EBAT. And so they would be the lead university on that type of technological assessment.
Outstanding. And, you know, it brings me to our Keep It Brief segment. And, you know, there's very little pressure. We almost never keep it brief. But when I was listening to you and I was looking at this article, and the thing that kept coming to mind is just the way that, you know, cancer is such a scary topic for pet owners. It's one of the things, it's one of the diagnoses that I think they get, right? Like you say cancer, they know what you're talking about. And it's such a scary, and in this case, incredibly malignant diagnosis. What are some of the strategies you use to help them navigate decision-making and understanding, especially when we have acute situations such as hemoabdomen? Like just as a veterinary professional, I feel like this is such a hard one for clients who are sitting in a room like, wait, what do you mean surgery or euthanasia? Like we were playing ball this morning and we kind of touched on it in the beginning, but we talked about the science part, like how do you navigate the client part of this?
Yeah, I think that navigating the client part is you need to have the clinicians that are empathic. Right. So they really have to understand the emotional turmoil, the roller coaster that pet owners are experiencing. They love their pet. Their pet seemed completely normal a day ago, and now they're on death's door. Right. And so I think compassion is going to be extremely important in helping pet owners understand that their decision, there's no wrong or right decision. Right. So as a profession, we need to be compassionate to understanding how pet owners feel. We have to at best be non-judgmental, right? We have to be open and understand perspectives. And so I think being a good veterinarian is a blend of qualities, right? You have to be very clinically sound, right? You have to know how to manage diseases. You have to understand the mechanisms. You have to understand the therapies. Equally important is the capacity to communicate with a pet owner, to gain the confidence of the pet owner, and very importantly, to reassure the pet owner that decisions that are being made, while they can be very emotionally difficult, there's no wrong or right to many of those decisions, and be supportive of their perspective. And so, especially in dogs that, you know, the owners are facing a life and death decision, right? That's, I don't think any of us would want to be put into a situation of that. And how we can help as professionals is to really provide them and educate them on the disease process and the expectations, and to support them through this emotionally tumultuous time for them.
Yeah, that's an incredible answer. You're right. It's multifaceted, just like the treatment, just like the condition. There's no one right or wrong or answer or path. It's truly about what's going to be best for the pet and the owner, and in empathy and compassion. You know, there's no end to that for, I feel like, most of us in this profession, and certainly in this case. Dr. Phan, thank you so much for all of this amazing information. Are there any resources you particularly enjoy or you feel like are great for people to go check out?
I think that Clinician's Brief and everything that you guys do is all very important. You know, I think that there are clinical trial sites, right? So I think that if pet owners are interested in looking for clinical trials for hemangiosarcoma, there are websites that kind of are updated pretty regularly so people can find the information that they're looking for. So that's what I would recommend doing.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Dr. Phan. Thank you for your time today. I'm sure we will have you back, and I look forward to hearing about all the amazing advancements you guys are making.
Thank you.
Thanks again to today's guest for joining us, and thanks to you for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, you can find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. While you're there, make sure you subscribe, rate, and review. We appreciate if you leave us all the stars. You can listen to podcasts as well on our website at cliniciansbrief.com/podcasts. You can find us at facebook.com
facebook.com/clinicians brief, on Twitter at clinicians brief, and on Instagram at clinicians.brief. You can also drop us a line at podcast@briefmedia.com. Clinicians Brief the Podcast is a Brief Media production, produced by Alexis Ustry, sound by Randall Stupka, hosted by me, Becky Mosser, with special thanks to production assistant Michelle Moncrez.